Senior Focus. Good afternoon. This is Anne-Marie Khoury, your presenter for this edition of Senior Focus. And I don't have anybody in the studio with me, but trust me, I've got lots of interesting things to talk about. But mostly what's on top at the moment is just looking at the big issues that are worrying people. This is an election year, and quite a lot of seniors groups are looking at how can they get attention about seniors' issues? How can they get them on the table? Because a lot of the policy decisions and a lot of the conversations around the election, they're sort of fairly cut and dry. They're agreed upon by the policy arm of the parties. And so when you go to meetings, you're presented with some stuff that won't rock the boat too much, stuff that's about keeping the middle of New Zealand happy, so we all stay afloat. And we can fairly much predict that there will be some things that we've already heard before. So how do we get seniors' issues on the table? And this is a really difficult thing, because in the past, seniors who wanted to get attention for issues joined Grey Power, and Grey Power was very numerous, and there were meetings held in halls up and down the country, and there was no social media. So the number of people on the seats, the number of people who marched to things, all of these things were counted, and they were all significant. They were all part of the conversation because they added weight. But we can't add weight in quite that way, because partly our numbers may have gone up, but a lot of the people are very vulnerable. They're not that mobile. So we have quite a large segment over 80 now, but they're not going to go out and march, and they're not even necessarily going to turn up in halls to listen to MPs talk. And so, to some extent, the normal sort of political process and channels is very much business as usual, and it's very pre-prepared speeches, and it's not too threatening, but it's bland, and it's not actually necessarily going to really do anything about what are the serious issues facing New Zealand. Just looking at the research that's around, evidence-based research is, to me, the most important thing behind this program, because we don't want to talk about things that aren't happening. We don't want to talk about yesterday and the good old days, and we don't want to talk about doomsday either. But we want to talk about the things that are actually happening on the ground. And for that, we have to rely on very quality research done by the likes of the Salvation Army Social Issues Policy Unit. We have to rely on the Co-Create Age people at Auckland University, who have university students studying the ageing process and how to age well. We have to rely on the Hope Foundation, who have 147 PhD scholarship students studying in New Zealand, and a lot of it is geared towards gerontology, study of ageing. So we're not short of material, but finding a way to bring it to life, finding a way to make it meaningful. Because when you're listening, it may impress you that to know what proportion of people are homeless and what proportion of people who are seniors live only on National Super and no other income. And I do look at these figures from time to time and mention them, but essentially that doesn't give you the whole picture. So we've had these very big events happening, these really big weather events, and it's worrying people. Every time it rains in some parts of the country, people get really nervous. And I obviously won't name areas, but Auckland is not unscathed. It may not be quite as bad as some parts of the Hawke's Bay and Gisborne, but it's pretty scary if you're anywhere out in the west where flooding occurred before, or you're in the low-lying floodplain of the North Shore. You won't be too happy because not too much has changed. Yes, the drains have been cleaned out and there's been more attention put on the routine maintenance. But this type of rain is having cumulative effects. Sometimes if we get 2 or 3 days in a row, and then we might get a breather for a couple of days, and then we get some more. The waterlogged soils can start to move, and that's what we saw on Mount Maunganui when the camping ground was ruined and lives were lost. And it's quite hard to think that actually it could have been prevented. We don't know exactly how fair that statement is. We will know when the report comes out and the inquiry is fully conducted. But at this stage, there were early warning signs and people tried to flag this as urgent and, oi, somebody needs to get in here quick. But it didn't happen. And so we are facing these kind of situations as individuals, as communities, and our councils are having to take a certain level of responsibility, and this concern about how things are going to unfold in the future. Have we got enough funds to cope? Will the insurance be able to cover people? Will people be able to afford the premiums? And these sorts of conversations are being held in people's living rooms, around dinner tables. They're not just things that I'm saying on the radio. So I do listen and I do interact with a number of seniors, and I'm hearing these discussions. And one of the things that's part of the discussion is how decisions are made. And in the past, we had a catchment board that looked after flooding. They looked after making sure that trees were planted on the riverbanks, and they looked ahead at what sort of patterns occurred, when flooding occurred, what needed to be planted where. And they were very good, solid, accountable institutions. They did what they set out to do. They were funded, and mostly they coped quite well. But the days of things being able to be siloed and able to be decided by just one body in isolation, those days are over. Because with climate change, we have, first of all, sudden unusual events. Secondly, we have impacts across very wide environments, and these impacts are both economic and environmental. So they affect the diversity of species. They also affect the viability of businesses. And we also see that there is certain fallout happens that may be thrusting parties against parties. We see people having really big arguments about what we should be doing, what we should be investing in, what we shouldn't be investing in. And so we don't always have unity. We don't always have everybody on the same page, and we don't always have a common lens to look at finding solutions together. And that is a real problem in itself. I notice that there are books coming out about the dangers of siloed policy making. It's one of the titles of a recent book I've come across. And people who are thinkers and writers are actually trying to explore problem solving needs to happen on a much higher level, a more strategic level. It needs to be more right across the board, and we need to really bring the climate change people together with the biodiversity champions, together with the people who are concerned about social cohesion. We need to bring them all together, and we need to look at things in a joined up collective way. And we haven't done this before. And this isn't how government works, because government has traditionally worked in siloed departments. And a department will go into bat for its funds, and it will jealously guard those funds. It won't want to necessarily have conversations with the department next door. And likewise, they might be concerned that if they share too much stuff, then that department might take over a project from them and take over their funding. So there has been a vested interest in keeping the silos going. And MPs often are tied into the siloed process. And so what data they collect locally and what data is focused on locally might be very much influenced by them and where they see things going. And they may not have anything other than a siloed approach as well. So it's a time of polycrises that cross the boundaries of existing narrow policy silos. It's a time of complexity where these polycrises come together and sometimes happen in multiple layers, sometimes happening simultaneously. And, of course, the upshot of these disasters is that people are affected, their livelihoods and their homes, and so there is an increase in homelessness. And it's worrying for people because they may have relatives and friends that are affected. They may have property themselves that they can't see how they can manage the cost of repairs on a pension. And there may be just the fear that, well, it's all going to happen again in a month's time or 3 months' time, and what will I do next time? I was lucky to survive this time. And so these are all the questions that are floating. These are all the things that keep people awake at night. These are the things that disturb people and frighten them. And politicians don't have answers, not in a global sense. They don't have necessarily a strategy. And they can fall back on growth or, well, if we put in a capital gains tax, we'll be able to afford to send everyone off to the doctor for free. Yes, these kinds of initiatives can be brought out, and they all sound good. But the thing is that those things aren't going to deal with the level of anxiety that's in the population. Doctors have talked at conferences in the last 5 to 10 years about the rising levels of anxiety that they are dealing with in their patient cases day to day. And it's a worry because they don't want to put people long term on medication just because people are afraid of living and afraid of what's entailed in life today. But on the other hand, the person is coming to them with a genuine sense of desperation. What are they going to do for them? So we're going to be focusing more on health during this year because it's a major concern of people. It's cropping up in the political polls. It's not the number one problem, but it's the number three problem. But it underlies so much. Your quality of life is nothing if you haven't got your health. And anyone who's grappled with a major health issue, or one or two or three of them, particularly chronic ones, would agree with me that your quality of life really begins to diminish rapidly if your health is seriously affected. So we need to focus on that, but we also need to find ways to have more conversations about this complexity of polycrises that are impacting on our country and on many countries around the world. I mean, this is not just reserved for us. And that's why a lot of the thinking, a lot of the news, a lot of the shared conversations on documentaries and so on is challenging, and it's going way beyond what conversations used to be about, because the seriousness of, will mankind survive climate change? Will we be able to do anything constructive that's going to affect change in time? And it's a little bit like changing the deck chairs on the Titanic, I think, sometimes. But that's in my negative phase. I'm a bit more optimistic than that. There are people doing some amazing things. I know of a project in Africa where they're building a green wall right across the central Sahara. And this project, many people said, oh, well, it's not going to work because it hasn't rained here for months or even last 2 years. How will these plants stay alive? But it's been quite miraculous how plantings have taken place and the heavens have opened up and rain has come for the first time in months to support these small seedlings. And seedlings have grown. And so over the last 8 to 10 years, trees and shrubs have been appearing, and more plantings are going on, and more teams are coming in to help, and so on. And so the whole project has flourished in a way that nobody could have foreseen. No one would have believed, and nobody could have imagined. And it's so beneficial because it's given a whole ecosystem back to the communities in these areas, so that there are insects there, there are birds, and they spread seeds, and there is more life force through the whole ecosystem. And locals can plant small seedlings underneath these trees and shrubs and harvest those. They can do herbs and seeds and spices and so on. So there's an amazing change being wrought just because people have collectively worked together, and it's taken a collective force. It's taken many teams of youth. Youth from all over Europe have travelled once a year to go and work on the project, and African youth have worked with them, and it's been multicultural, it's been diverse in the spread of people that are involved, and it's gone way beyond the countries involved. And that's just such a vision of what mankind can do if they're motivated, and if they are unified, and if they're working as a collective. And it takes that vision, it takes somebody to come up with the plan and others to buy into that. And then it reaches momentum and takeoff point. I think there are some lights in New Zealand along, not as fantastic and as well organised and bold as that great green wall, but there are some very positive signs in New Zealand. I noticed the sanctuary in Collingwood at the top of the South Island. They've got a predator fence which they have funded through a business plus the community. And on that model, they reached their final target, and so the whole thing is now a viable project, and I think it will be completed by next year, and this will really improve the whole diversity of species in that area, because it will keep everything safe. It's big enough to be a great renewal space and give great opportunity for species to evolve in numbers. But at the same time, it's small enough to be manageable, to be something that's a doable project that the community could afford to sponsor and support. And people have been very excited by it and very dedicated towards seeing it happen. People in the local area, I mean. But, of course, donations have come from all over the country. I think a similar thing happened with Chum's Beach, that very well-known isolated beach in the Coromandel, which is very wonderful and great place to visit. And we've got some other sorts of projects around in Taranaki. I know there's a fence, predator fence around Parongia, and that's worked very well. That's perhaps not so well known. It hasn't had quite so much publicity, but it's just that we are moving towards empowering people to think about the future in a positive way. And that's the beauty of radio, that we can activate people's thinking, that we can inspire you to get involved and find out more about what's happening in your neighbourhood. What can you do about improving biodiversity? And so that was what we did last week, interviewing Jackie Knight from the Moths and Butterflies Trust, because Jackie's worked for over 20 years to ensure that the species of butterflies and moths that we have are given as much chance of protection as possible. And she's engaged schools in their science curriculum, actually getting students to observe the butterflies in action, count the butterflies, monitor numbers, learn about habitats. And all this has been very fruitful, and of course the website supports a lot of this activity, and it's wonderful to see older people using their digital skills to support these initiatives and to work as volunteers and backing up what Jackie is doing. And I suggest, if you haven't been to their website, that you do pay a visit to it, because I think you'll be really amazed at what's going on. Sometimes our news on the TV can be very bleak at night, and we can be a bit deluged by what's being presented without actually having a balance about the positive things that are actually going on in our very midst. I'm also mindful that a lot of people went to Waitangi at the weekend, and they put a great effort into making that trek north because they care about nurturing the foundation document that is behind our structure of organising things in New Zealand. And I think it's really worthwhile to know that organisations like the Tyndall Foundation, started by the person who invented the warehouse, Stephen Tyndall, the Tyndall Foundation is a foundation set up to help New Zealand cope with social issues, social problems, to build social cohesion. And they have, as a team, all of their staff involved in visiting Waitangi. And they've been doing this now for a couple of years. They've taken the whole staff en masse to go to Waitangi to learn just exactly what is the scope, what is the direction, what is the feeling behind the document, what is the birthplace of the document like, and what is it like to participate in the live interactions that go on at Waitangi itself on the treaty ground. And in this education process, of course, it's opened up many questions. It's been a huge learning exercise and been a very rich learning exercise. And something that they have engaged in such a way as it's been ongoing. And the staff have voluntarily wanted to come back the next year and carry on. And that actually says volumes, actually. It says a lot for the respect and the quality of interactions that go on at Waitangi. It's not just what you see on the media. And also the commitment of the staff then to how they actually enact being in partnership with Māori, how they support Pacifica and Asian people to integrate into our society and to understand our treaty background and our bicultural foundations. And so they are funding all sorts of organisations at work, working on social cohesion, working on greater understanding, greater capacity to respond to diversity within our country. And so what they fund is very much a reflection of what they value and what they have been learning about and what they have taken on board through their visits to Waitangi. So I'm very interested to follow through and see more the outflow of this over the next few years. And I think that this has been a great role model situation because it's inspired other companies, other small businesses and other foundations and funders to look into how they can do something similar. We can be uplifting as a nation. We can uplift one another. We can work at the individual level, we can work at the organisational level, and we can work to ensure that we vote people into government who are going to give us the best outcomes, who are prepared to look at what strategies are needed to solve problems, who are prepared to go up to 10,000 feet and take a decent overview and see what's really going on instead of trying to just package a quick off-the-cuff kind of middle-of-the-road, bland response. Thanks for listening today, and we'll love to have you back with us next Sunday, and we have more exciting things on offer.
Get together with Senior Focus next Sunday at 5:25 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6 or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/Senior Focus, and do note Senior Focus is one word.
Baby.